All right. Also, it goes as a podcast, right?
Yeah, this is also a podcast. You got to kind of one of the rules of content marketing, man. You got to sort of make multiple sort of assets from it all. Anyway, we are live. So welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air, episode 20. Would you believe I'm still doing it? Episode 20. And I'm super excited today, everyone. Two reasons. First reason is because I'm doing this live from sunny Lisbon, rapidly becoming one of my favorite cities. And secondly, because Adam Gordon has once again been upgraded, which I'm delighted about. Because we now have, as my co-host, a good friend of mine and a great guy to know in tech recruiting, Pedro Oliveira, co-founder at Landing Jobs. Pedro, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lee. Really nice to be here. I mean, I've been following you for ages. I met you before there was any recruiting in Brentford.
You know what? That is true. And I met you before there was a Landing Jobs, didn't I?
You did.
Back in the day when, you know, I noticed old Jobbox was this cool little Portuguese company doing some interesting things. So,
yeah, long time ago.
Indeed so. So listen, we always start in the same way, which is a quick review of Recruiting Brain Food from last week. So I know you've been a real supporter of the newsletter, Pedro. So I wanted to just dive in and say, what was it from issue one for one that you thought was particularly interesting for you?
So yeah, again, I always follow the newsletter every Sunday. And it's my Sunday read, basically. The one that strike me as like, okay, I have to read this, was the 20 important KPIs for measuring event success. Because, I mean, we had Landing Festival this week happening in Lisbon. We are at it right now. And
I was going to say, we're actually broadcasting live on Landing Fest. Exactly. So this is the link that was shared, I think, by a guy called Ivan Harrison. And it's about, okay, you're going to go to an event. How do you measure the ROI? If you're a delegate or a sponsor or you're a partner of some type, there's going to be spend. There's going to be expenses. Yeah. Like, how do you measure the return?
From a perspective of the event organizer as well. So if you are, and we're going to talk about it inbound and stuff, but if you are organizing meetups and stuff, these are the KPIs. I mean, some of them are pretty obvious. There was another article on the Brain Food about hiring KPIs from Google.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I believe you said something on the, but I think that was from the last one. And you said something on the Facebook group that, you know, some of them are pretty obvious, but people still click on it and want to know, like, maybe I'm missing out on a couple of them. And I think my feeling was the same here with the events. Maybe we track a lot of stuff, but maybe I'm missing out on a couple of them. So that's why, like, I found it interesting, basically.
Was there any one of those 20 KPIs?
You know, pretty much. There's one, like, the number of active community members. This is like something I never thought about it. Like, okay, obviously it's a community usually joining together, unless you have something huge like Web Summit. I wouldn't call it a community, more like a wave of people arriving in a specific moment in a specific place. But you know, there's like metric number four, number of active community members. So they actually look at events as moments in time within a community. Okay. So, and this was the thing. I was like, okay, it makes sense. And you know, sometimes you read this stuff and it just puts things into another perspective. You know.
You know what? I think that's actually a critical point, because the set piece events that you just march in and march out of, I think that's kind of going away. So like, there's no kind of persistent value for the delegate. And then typically the old expo style stuff costs a lot of money to attend. You walk in, you walk out, there's nothing after until another year comes by and you have to attend again. But what I like about these smaller events or even the more boutique stuff is that they think about events as part of a wider and more persistent community play. which is in fact what you guys do. I mean, Landing Fest itself is also connected with the Lisbon recruiter community or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, so I can maybe give you a bit of a history wrap up. I'll try to be short. So when we changed our brand name from Jobbox, which I know you love, but when we changed it to Landing Jobs, by the way, Jobbox had a lot of selling problems. I mean, Jobbox was crazy to sell. But then when we change it, we basically did an event to celebrate that. That's when Landing Festival, you know, came out. And, you know, it was just a one-time thing. But it was like the community really came out. They believed in what we were doing, what we were trying to do, trying to achieve. And, like, they came out to support us and felt like, okay, we're going to do something about it. And then the two following editions, it was more like, okay, still a community event, obviously, but more with the job fair twist. But then we figured out, like in 2017, we figured out, okay, this is not really working. It attracts a lot of junior talent, which is fine, you know, but you know, you go to universities for that, which they have their own communities. That's cool, you know. You want to go to Imperial College and do something there, fine, you know, you just have access to that community. It's totally fine. And we kind of revamped it, and we continue to do that, to a tech conference. Okay, so tech and careers conference. So to put people also like talking about contractors, how to become contractors, salaries, you know, how to manage their careers, but also the tech side of things. And sometimes with interesting panels to join both sides, recruiters and tech professionals and hiring managers as well. So we're trying to move in that direction to content.
Yeah, I mean, and the content is fantastic. So if people want to check out landingfest.com, landingfestival.com right now, that link, you can just see on the agenda, you got some amazing speakers on there from the technology side as well as from the recruiting side. So I think that's something often missing from the tech recruiter community, because we're often talking to ourselves, aren't we? You know, but we're not talking actually to the engineering leaders and the people that we need to the recruit from. So I love the fact that you've got those people involved.
Yeah, okay, we had one specific event a couple of days ago, the tech hiring conference, which is more for the tech recruiters and also hiring managers. There was a specific panel about the clash between recruiters and hiring managers. It wasn't really a clash, you know, the clash. But I wasn't able to watch it, so I had to ask feedback to speakers, which is one of the metrics, by the way. And I asked them, you know, how did it go? And then they said it was great, because they usually don't talk in such an open space about the problems that each other have, and it just helps, you know, as a community. Yep.
That's it. It's all about trying to open up those communication channels, which is great. Okay. Another thing on recruiting brain food last week. What else was interesting for you, Pedro?
So let me check again. There was the I'm already getting ahead of myself. I was gonna say the anti-recruiter thing, the big bounce, but no, let's stop for a bit. So there was the nefarious LinkedIn as well.
Yes.
So these were the two that I liked. So the event KPIs, for obvious reasons, and then it kind of joined the community, and the nefarious LinkedIn. It just like it's kind of related with the inbound outbound. So it's kind of LinkedIn is actively blocking all this activity that happens on LinkedIn that they do not control. You know, from a vendor perspective, it makes sense. Okay. You know, they're doing like if I own LinkedIn. Well, if I was Microsoft, which owns LinkedIn, I probably would do the same. But then at the same time, it's like, I mean, LinkedIn started as a sales thing, and now it's clearly a recruiting tool. And I mean, it's kind of like they're blocking too much. I don't know. So this guy went on to write, you know, he's a software, from a software developer perspective, and what they're doing. So he went really dig deeper. You know, some of the vocabulary is not easy to understand, but it was cool read, basically.
I liked it as well. I mean, I think when you read that post, and I've just shared the link on the chat there, it probably not too much we can do with it, but it was still very interesting to understand how LinkedIn actually monitors what plugins you've got on Chrome, and how it understands actually that's something we want to try and block and get rid of. And actually quite significant if you want to kind of stay out of LinkedIn jail. I mean, that's kind of a cliche these days, but I've seen more and more people in the recruiter community visit the jail, and that can actually be devastating for us. You know, if you're a recruiting professional, the truth is you can't really do without LinkedIn, I would say. It's a massive handicap to actually lose it. And I know a few prominent recruiters that have been bombed off it. And then you think, wow, that's hugely damaging to your business, you know?
Did they get back or jail for life?
It seems that there's no way to get it back. So at least one guy is literally on jail and he's gone. Like, he needs to start it from scratch again. Which you can imagine how much time and effort and energy that sort of takes.
The content lost, everything lost.
You've got to take care of your LinkedIn. Yeah. So I think that maybe the era of cheap and easy and cool Chrome extensions are coming to a close. You know. Okay, let's move on to the meat of the topic here. We want to both you and I have been trying to solve the same problem in the terms of how do we, make tech recruiting better for everyone involved in the process. Because we do know that it's generally a miserable experience from the recruiter side as well as from the engineering side. It's just a general hard grind. And I just wanted to explore the online marketplaces play, because, again, we started Workshape probably similar time you guys did Landing Jobs. Where is that market now? It's been 5 years, really, since it's been going. What does the online recruiter marketplace look like as far as you're concerned, Pedro?
So, like, I think you have to take a history lesson here. So we had the agencies, back in the day, it was like you had job boards, offline job boards, and then agencies started to appear, and then online job boards, and then aggregators. And then the old traditional players started buying the new players, and then marketplaces appear, and some other tools as well, like the ATS and stuff like that appeared as well. Marketplaces appeared. I think, like, from my perspective, like hired.com was kind of a big, even though, like, American, they couldn't get a hold of Europe, to be honest, but they were kind of like the first ones to do it. It kind of changed the game, in a way. So we started to, instead of just being a job board where you can post your jobs and collect leads, which is fine, there's some people like saying job boards are dead, like, fuck no, job boards are not dead. And the proof of that is that, like, some rent studies buying monster.com, these kind of things, it's happening. So I believe that in the future, the traditional players, like, for instance, there was the and it's already started to happening. So the hired competitor in New York, Vettery, was bought by Adecco. Right. So it's already happening. So I believe the traditional players will consume. They will buy marketplaces like the ones we are operating. Okay. The same way they have bought job boards. Now, you could argue, like, aggregators, for instance, Indeed has become, like, big, They're having some troubles because of Google for jobs in Europe. But I think the major advantage of marketplaces, and you can see that on Hired, for instance, is that they purchased another company for tech assessments.
On that note, Indeed, they've got their own marketplace, right? Indeed Prime, direct competitor to the likes of Hired, and in fact, I believe they're going to do a big push on that. Q3, expect a big splash from those guys.
So I think, like, it's something, whether they do it on their own, like Indeed is doing. Maybe like Indeed could buy Hired and then merge it into Prime. So maybe that could happen. They're having some trouble with Google for Jobs in Europe, so maybe they can do it in the US, kind of like concentrate their power in the United States. Actually, Chad and Cheese podcast, which was mentioned on the newsletter as well on Brain Food, they had like some episodes ago. They do a lot of episodes, some are short, some are big. They talked about it, like Indeed is concentrating
their energies in the US.
Let me interrupt you now, Pedro, because if people are not listening to Chad and Cheese, you definitely need to. And in terms of keeping up to date with market activities and market trends, who's buying who or what, these guys have got it nailed. A weekly podcast, they know before anybody else knows.
Some Twittering as well, so, but you know, if you're okay with that, it's fine.
Oh yeah, they're it's not politically correct, let's say. But that's fine. Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's move on from marketplaces. My two cents on this is that I think that marketplaces as a they've gone down that traditional route of trying initially to disrupt the agency market and get rid of the third party, which we definitely try to do. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I think that what has been revealed is that recruitment in the end still requires quite a lot of manual input. And I can see that the marketplace have kind of stepped back a little bit towards agencies in terms of their basic business model. The charging processes are similar, for instance, charge on kind of higher. There's also more manual labor involved now. So you've got lots of people doing things like talent advocacy or talent management and so on, which, you know,
so RPOs.
Taking on a little bit of that style. So all of this is positive because the net result of it is you will have better product, I would say, better service than a traditional agency.
Yeah.
But maybe not the initial dream of having a completely, what was it, automated but a smooth, broker-free experience. I don't think that's the thing that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think like that was the dream, you know, in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I definitely don't think it happened. I mean, I'm running one. You're running one. I took like my approach to that was from a macro perspective, like, you know, what the market is and the big boys are going to buy smaller fish. I agree with you. Basically, and from a functionality perspective, we're definitely approaching the agency, but with a different background. Does it make sense?
It makes sense, and I tell you something. It's also important because that the DNA is different and the motivation is different. And I think the candidate experience is different. So I hope it's an improvement.
One of the things that is different is also the community part. It's something I believe we've been doing right. It's something I believe we've been doing right as well. I still remember Workshop with the surveys and stuff. That was cool, you know. Like, so I think we have that approach. And I don't see like Randstad or Kelly Services or any other like having that approach. And when they have, it never sounds authentic. And communities, they have to be authentic.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, I'm a big advocate of community as a method of having interactions with people outside of the context of recruitment. Because recruitment's hard. You know, it's one of those things that it's difficult to really pay too much attention to when you're not actively looking. So we need to find other ways to have conversations. I'm interested in community. I'm going to try and bring a few guests on from the Portuguese market. I think the community is rapidly growing here and we're maturing our understanding of how to do community. So I wonder whether we can get Ana Gaspar on here, our good friend. I'll see if I can invite her along. We're in the middle of a festival, by the way, so this might not happen.
Let's see. So
don't hate us for this. But Anna's somewhere. She's on the floor somewhere. So hopefully she can get this message.
I'm here.
Oh, there she is.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I don't know if the sound is good because I'm really in the middle of the festival. Is it okay?
It's perfectly fine.
Okay, nice.
You're overly loud, but I think that's just you, Anna. Okay. I think that's nothing to do with the tech. So nice, Anna, great to have you with us. We just got on talking about communities in recruiting. And I know that you've got like a really interesting job now, doing something community-wise for Volkswagen as from a recruitment side, isn't it? So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So basically, Volkswagen opened a new software development center in Lisbon. And like worldwide, creating tech teams and recruiting for your team is always a challenge. So they wanted to be creative. So my role is I'm the ambassador of the office. and basically because we are recruiting certain types of profiles, and we don't want to do like a kind of like we at Landing Jobs is quite well known this term. We don't want to fish with a net. We want to fish with just like single and individual profiles. We believe that communities and bringing people inside the office, interacting with the team and know the people that work in our team, with events, with meetups, with tours around the office, we believe that it can help create better and quality with better quality pipeline to the recruitment process. So yes, community is something that is really definitely super important for us in Lisbon. I try to get in touch with the majority of the communities that are operating in Lisbon and creating a relationship with them, and it's going quite well. And we try to be diverse, but always to keep the quality like one of the main frameworks of the meetup. So we don't work with all of them, but the majority of them, yes.
How would you say, you know, if there's a recruiter listening to you right now, Anna, and they mm-hmm. they're bought into this idea of trying to move away from transactional recruiting and they want to try and do something community-wise, what advice would you give them if they were just starting out thinking about this?
Okay, so my first tip, it was depending on your location and the country that you are, try to understand which platforms are these communities being run, and also try to know the people that are the makers of the community. So if you have, I don't know, if you are in Paris or in London, you know that certain people and certain players of the community make things happen. You have to get to know them, understand what is their vision in terms of events, what is going on trends, even on tech stacks, what's going on, understand which kind of events, even conference, international conference, they would advise people to go. So I would really give these two tips, get to know the right people and understand the platforms where these communities are being managed on. And you have to be there.
Yeah, that's amazing. So firstly, obviously, there's going to be amplifiers in these spaces, and you need to identify who are these people that have this ability to communicate to a large audience. So follow-up question on this, Anna, and I'll let Pedro ask you a few questions a bit later after this. But so I found this person. This person is an important individual in the community. How do I make an approach to this individual? I'm a recruiter. I'm a kind of a hated individual. But how do I make an approach to this person that is made welcome and they can see that I'm actually trying to add value?
Okay. Basically, the process that I'm been doing is to be super informal in a way that I just write a message, an online message, via Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever that person is. And of course also to analyze the answer back. Let's be honest, if someone doesn't want to meet you, it's okay. You just have to just say, okay, no worries. I'm just gonna try to get to the next person. And when they eventually say, yeah, I also would like to meet you, I just start with a video call, just a super informal call to get to know that person, understand what they do, what is their role in the company, where is their role in the community they are developing in. More stuff. If the video call goes well and they actually have kind of a chemistry with that person, why not like to invite for a drink or for a coffee or even to get to know your company inside your office, for them to, if you have a space in your company to host events, I think is the perfect time for you to show your office to this person. And after this face-to-face meeting, try to arrange something together, like an event or something super informal, because at least here in Lisbon, I found out, because we have a lot of contact with other realities in Germany, especially in Berlin, like because we are Volkswagen. Portugal is really it's really a baby in terms of communities, which gave us a lot of space also to build and help building the communities here. But for example, London, Berlin, the community range is just a monster. So you have a lot of space to play and a lot of people to get to know. So don't be shy, to be honest. I mean, I think recruiters are used to get no's, right? So
yeah, yeah.
Right. So
actually, I've like not maybe two people know, but then sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yep. You okay?
So not many people know, but Anna used to work for Landing before she joined Volkswagen. And I already asked Anna on WhatsApp, but she never replied. So I'm going to ask you, hoping for a reply. No, not today. I asked you a couple of months ago. So basically, I think like, you know, you called yourself an ambassador, which is great. Mm-hmm. So I have actually a couple of questions. One is like, I want to hire someone like you. Okay. And hopefully in the future, recruiting brain food, maybe they want to hire someone like you as well. What would be the main, you know, main requirements if you had to build a job spec? And then the KPIs as well, like how do I measure your performance as an ambassador?
Okay, so I would say that the main characteristics is to be a networker. You have to know how to deal with people, with especially in tech, it's really complicated because people are socially a bit more introvert, which is okay. You just have to hire someone that is extrovert in a way that they understand introvert people, because you can be like super outgoing and super energetic and people feel intimidated about that. So you really have to know how to measure your energy level when you're talking with a lot of tech industry. So definitely a people's person, is this correct to say? Or a person, I don't know, say in English, yeah? So I would say that this is the main characteristic. And then in terms of KPIs, I'm going to be super honest. This is also a test in Lisbon. So basically what we are doing so far is to measure the amount of, we call them kind of hiring tech events. So we basically are testing different kind of events at our office. We are trying to understand if working with communities, doing internal like with only with our brand events. So basically my KPI was to organize X amount of events in per semester and understand the outputs of these events. Did it create pipeline? If yes, how many people? How many went to the interview? How many got hired, you know? Again, as an ambassador, I would say that you try to identify and target a certain amount of a specific profile. So we are trying to hire that person. It's not like it's not in terms of amount that can be comms or marketing or employer branding, but this is really a targeted job. You know, it's like micro recruiting, not micro recruiting, if I can call it like this.
Anna, yep. let me stop you there. I mean, I think that we'd be very interested to know about your experiment here, especially as the numbers that you generate, because this is quite a new thing. You know, the idea of of hiring people that don't have, if you like, transactional recruitment responsibility, but have this ecosystem support responsibility, because we know that's going to translate into hires further down the line. I'd love to get a better understanding as to what the job is. I've already learned something about the kind of characteristics, but particularly on the KPI side, I think that could be a really good blog that brain fooders would definitely love to read. So let's talk about that once you're into it.
Okay. So in terms of numbers and certain numbers, first I cannot share, and second they are not that specific. The thing is,
you can share it.
I can't. I would just
have a word.
She's at the Volkswagen space. Maybe if you move away, then.
But wait.
Your boss is right there. I can see him. I'm going to go have a word with him after this, and you can share this.
What I can say is that my activities will impact the beginning of the hiring funnel. So my actions will impact the people that enter the hiring funnel. You know what I mean? So the exact beginning of the hiring funnel. And basically what I want to measure, because my competitor in terms of my team is a communications team, because we are both feeding the hiring funnel, not competitor in a bad way, in a good way. And I want to understand from the people that they bring with their actions, like with their macro actions, compared with my micro actions, if I deliver less but good quality, if they deliver quantity and less quality. Try to understand what works better, what doesn't work better, or what works worse. The thing is, we are such in a competitive area and so hard to recruit tech that we have to be creative and we have to test new stuff. So I don't know, and we don't have that much experience in this kind of field because we're just trying. You know, Volkswagen in Lisbon has like 1 year now. I just joined a few couple of months ago. We are trying to be creative, trying to reach people that are from different pods, because product teams and product companies are always trying to go to the same pods of people. Try to be creative, try to be different. If you ask me, okay, if you want to reach, I don't know, if you want to put in your pipeline X amount of people in the next quarter, what you going to do? Next week, I'm going to think about it, and I'm going to be creative, and I'm going to reach a solution. But, you know, it's
what's
like
your,
this.
What's your reach or impact or... like how do you deal, especially with the comms team, communications team, like in terms of social media, because you also have access to it, right? Or they give you access to it, right?
No, I have actually have the access to the social media, but I have access to the social media, but only two platforms, only the Instagram and the Twitter account, because are the two accounts that you have to be updated on a daily basis. And because our communications team doesn't sit with us every day, and I sit with the team every day, I want to report what is happening at the office, what's going on at events, so that can be updated on a daily
basis. Why not LinkedIn then? I mean,
because we believe that the tech community is more active on Twitter, for example, than on LinkedIn. But this is my personal experience, okay? So, of course,
LinkedIn it was a trap important. Question. I knew what you were going to reply.
No, okay.
But it, exactly.
That's great, Anna. Anna, thank you very much for your time. You've been amazing. I really appreciate you. I mean, it's great to see your enthusiasm. And I can absolutely see Volkswagen have made a brilliant hire there, actually.
Thank you.
Pedro, you made a disastrous effort not keeping hold of this lady.
You need boomerang employees, man. Boomerang employees.
You need to look at your retention approach, dude.
Boomerang strategy,
I just to be clear, I love landing jobs. I left because new challenges came ahead, okay? Landing jobs is the best.
You should have done it.
That's great. Anna, listen, I know you've been busy. So we'll let you go. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
On the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cool. That was a great description of the job, you know. It reminds me of that developer evangelist role that you see coming out of B2B tech companies in Silicon Valley.
It's slightly different because I think the dev evangelist or developer relations, and there's some really nice newsletters. I can share the link. I just need to find it on my email about DevRelf. And basically, they also have, they have a technical background. Like Anna doesn't have a technical background. They have a technical background. They produce some documentation stuff, but they overlap a little bit. They do.
Yeah, I didn't mean that they were kind of identical or the swappable, but in terms of their KPI style, you know, if you look at how they're measured, it's similar in the sense it's like you're not there to you know move this number of people in this stage. It's all about trying to support the ecosystem. And build a brand in a much more sophisticated way. So, but it's great to see Volkswagen take that risk and build this type of role. I'd love to see more companies do it because I think it will give you a huge competitive advantage if you can start interacting with these hard to hire people in a way that is not processing them through some sort of pipeline. Okay, let's keep talking about hiring developers. We know this is a very difficult thing to do. And we had a conversation over dinner actually a couple of days ago about sort of develop sort of countermeasures. We know that developers have been overwhelmed by recruitment messaging, and that they're starting to take steps to evade this, aren't they? And you shared with me a very interesting link about this, some sort of pay to receive type of software, which is, you know, wow, this is obviously a clear response to two people being over messaged.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's like recruiters or salespeople, you know, just people that do outbound. Okay, let's put it like this. Now, the way I found out about it is like I have people register on landing jobs the same way you have people register on Workshape. And, you know, we do, you know, like they opt in to our communications or opt out, you know, that's it's fine. And then for the ones that opt in, like we sent some marketing campaigns and stuff like that. And we started getting a couple of these from BigBounce. And basically, it shows like you have two options. You know, you send an email and then you get an email back from BigBounce that says person X, blah, blah, blah. You're not whitelisted on person X's email. And you have two options. Either you pay an amount of money, which can be like 5 cents. I've seen $0.05, $5 or $5.
Or so, you can. So the receiver sets the amount, doesn't he? Like he can say, it's gonna cost you $10 to email me, man.
Yeah, you have a second option, which is to ask me to whitelist you. Okay. And by the way, BigBounce, you know, pricing is they get 30% cut on you know. When people decide. No, we were discussing it over dinner, and you know, my feelings, and this is a bit of a feeling thing. Like, so we first of all, we weren't doing an outbound approach. Should they register? And then we got this. We were using their permission, so it was fine, GDPR compliant, everything, blah blah. And then I got this and I'm like, okay, this is new. Let's check it out. So it happened like 2-3 times. And, you know, it just, the feeling was weird, you know, like I didn't hate it, you know, at first. And then I started thinking, like, I'm a positive guy. So I was thinking, well, maybe it's better for me to pay 5 cents to this person than to spend 5 cents on Facebook, you know. But I haven't made up on my mind on where I stand on this. It's just a trend. It's a micro trend. I think they have 300K people registered on it. At least that's what they say on the on their site, I believe. And we have to pay attention to these sort of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that firstly, I don't like it, obviously, because it's a little. I would never imagine myself paying any money for this. It's a little bit. I mean, we talked about it before. It's the psychology of paying even a micro amount, and then having that person ignore you anyway. It doesn't guarantee a response, right? So I could set a number. I could say, Pedro, it's going to cost you $10 for this email to get through. You think, oh my God, I'll pay the $10, but what if I don't respond? You're going to feel like such a chump.
And you're an asshole, you know?
Yeah, I'm a total asshole, yeah.
They
probably need to do something about that. Like maybe you refund the money back if I accept it and don't respond. Maybe there's a way in which you could recover the amount. So that would be something I would suggest is an evolutionary step for these guys. But
yeah, I mean
it's an outcome of too much email going out. It's an outcome of too much outbound unsolicited stuff. And I know these guys, in your case, signed up willingly for the service.
Yeah.
But their using of this service is not designed probably against you. It's designed against all the other stuff, and you've been caught up in it as collateral damage. So you know, I think that's going to affect everyone, right? You're going to have barriers to communication because we're overly communicating. What do we do about this? That's the big question I think we have.
I think like GDPR when it came out was a big thing, you know, like platforms like ours, we were always concerned about user privacy. We didn't want to spam users too much, you know. And this is kind of like maybe an extreme measure, but maybe for people who are more antisocial or something, maybe it works for them. I don't know. Like I still have to make up my mind about it. It didn't bring me super negative feelings. Yeah, I'm a man enough to say that feelings. Didn't bring me super
feeling, negative.
Fine. But yeah, it wasn't like positive as well. So I'm kind of going in between. Let's see where it comes. I'm going to keep following this trend, and I think we as a community, we have to
monitor
it. This. But it brings us to the outbound and inbound issue, right?
Yeah, I mean, outbound versus inbound. You know, I've had a road to Damascus conversion on this. You know, outbound is generally not the way, especially for the kind of businesses that I like to run. I think it's not about converting on outbound. And it's all about investing in the inbound side and getting them to come to you, which is a longer play. It just takes longer to do. And you probably need to just probably chew on a loss of revenue for a longer period, but I hope that the rewards in the end are going to be significantly better, because if you've got command of an audience, then I think you're going to be in much better shape when these types of countermeasures start arising, you know.
Look, in terms of inbound, like I'm a huge believer as well, like I think that's the way. Sometimes when you have more businesses that pressure you more, like, you know, some agencies, let's say in London, you know, just by chance, that they have a lot of pressure, and obviously they're going to use outbound. And it's kind of the metrics are kind of like, they should be different. I don't know, like the KPIs that you're measuring on, like number of calls, it still happens today, you know? And you know this, I know this, we know people that still do it, and it's like the KPIs are not super sustainable, but I guess that's society in general, you know.
The thing is, the model's worked, you know. Recruitment agency in particular is a multi-billion dollar turnover business in the UK. It's worth like 225 billion, I think. Worldwide, it's like 200 billion. And most of it is still done through the outbound way. So there is a kind of clear business reason to do it. But at the same time, you can see it's really damaging how people perceive the industry. And there's countermeasures being being put in. And eventually, we're gonna find different ways to do it. But tech hiring is a problem. So I'm going to bring in our second guest, who is a lady we both know, who you know, is heavily involved in recruiting developers here, and also actually runs a CRM tool, which I wonder, you know, whether she uses it for recruiting in some way. This is Anna Tavares from Pipedrive. So let me see if Anna's here. Anna's actually on a stand right now, so I wonder whether she might actually be in conversation with some developer, but let's see. Let's hope not. Anyway, we'll wait for Anna to come on if she's there. So tell me about tech hiring in Lisbon in particular, Pedro. We know it's a booming market, loads of great developers here, but loads of people recruiting these developers from different countries, different companies.
There we go.
Oh, there she is. Hey, Anna, how are you doing?
Hey, Anna.
I'm at the
Are you okay? Are you really? How's it all going? Are you hiring loads of people?
Yeah, tons of it, because we have the ham guy with us. We have Miguel. We have the ham guy.
That's it. It's the way to recruit in Portugal is to have a big sort of leg of ham sliced away.
Never
ham guy.
Okay, so
actually,
Anna,
I'll put a picture. What is it, man? It's in Portuguese, it's presunto, right?
Presunto, yeah.
Okay, I got it.
I'll put a picture here. Yeah, it's delicious. It's the best one
because it's pata negra.
Is it better than the Berco ham?
Yeah.
Okay, so Anna, listen, the reason why we bring you on, because you have been recruiting tech people for Pipedrive in Lisbon for a number of years now. So I wanted to kind of bring you on to the show to just get your views to what the tech hiring scene is here. What is it like to recruit Portuguese developers in particular? How are you recruiting international people and so on? I mean, what is your basically state report for tech hiring in this city?
Well, I would say that tech hiring is getting more difficult because the market is small. We don't have a lot of engineers. If you see some metrics about the students that go to the university for technical courses, the number is smaller and smaller every year. So obviously the number of people that get out of the university ready to join a tech company as a developer, it's smaller. And this is a big challenge. That's why we need to recruit a lot of international developers as well, which is awesome because mixed culture teams work perfectly well, and we love that at Pipedrive. Only in the Lisbon office, we have around 11 different cultures and nationalities, and in Pipedrive as a global team, we have around 42 different cultures and nationalities, and this is amazing. But I believe that the Lisbon tech scene is getting even more savvy, even more curious about what's popping in the market. They like to hang around, they like to attend meetups. At Pipedrive, we do at least one technical meetup per month in our office. And in these meetups, we always have one Pipedrive speaker and one external guest from another tech company. And what happens is that you start building the relationship with these developers, and when they're ready to move, they will remember of you. They will remember that event that they went at Pipedrive. They will remember that recruiter that was there presenting the company and speaking a little bit about the culture and about the challenges that they can find at the company. So I would say that hiring tech talent in Portugal, it's like preparing for a wedding, like for your own wedding. You know, you need to start the relationship. You need to nurture the relationship. You need to make it rise to that point of interest when the wedding gets consumed, per se.
Okay.
You know what? Thanks, Anna. It's actually relevant. I mean, it does come back to a little bit of, you know, human relationships, really. You know, sometimes I think recruiters, because we recruit all the time, you know.
Everywhere, anyway. Yeah, totally.
We don't realize that candidates don't think about jobs discovery 100% of the time. It's for them a lot more episodic. So for us to constantly ask people to immediately take an interest in a job opportunity we have, when they're not familiar with your brand, they've never spoken to you before, they don't know who you are, your ability to convert a highly skilled in-demand person is going to be quite low. You've just got to get lucky that that person happens to be in that, you know, moment where they're considering a few things. The smarter way to do it, obviously, is to have many more interactions in advance of the need to do so. And communities, events, that's the way to do it.
There are candidates that I've been following for years. I even know the name of the wives, the kids, when they got married. It's a real relation that has been built with the time.
Well, I mean, Lee's come up with some interesting comments on the sideline there. And I think he's questioning, look, this is obvious. Like, why shouldn't we do it? So I'll ask the question, like, why don't recruiters do it? Because yeah. Truthfully, most recruiters don't. I mean, the fact is most recruiters are still transactional. And we know that through the feedback that we get from the candidate community, particularly the engineers. But there's got to be a reason for that. So was there a moment in Pipedrive's sort of journey where you decided that actually this relationship building was a critical concern?
Yes, I felt since the beginning. I was thinking, and the better way to respond to answer to your question is that since the beginning, when I started doing tech recruitment, and it was not on Pipedrive, it was on my previous company, I started understanding that this relationship creation was fundamental for attracting and for hiring tech talent. So when I came to Pipedrive and I understood that I was heading a brand that no one knew at the market still, I understood that this was even more needed to establish connections and to get them know our brand, get them know our culture. And this is something that comes with time. It's not...
So it comes, yeah, it comes with your experience, Anna. I'll tell you something. Lee's mentioned something really interesting as well, because he did say that a big part of the problem is probably the inexperience of recruiters. Because there's no barrier to entry. Anybody can, you know, we could set up a recruitment company today and start making calls, and no one's going to stop us from doing that. So imagine there's a young recruiter that is starting out for the first time, and they understand the need to have a long-term relationship with this audience, but they're struggling to persuade the management that this is important. What would your kind of advice to that recruiter be? How do they make the internal case to the management that they should build this?
Change companies, man. If you're working for a boss that does not understand that this is all about connection and relation, you're not going nowhere, and probably that company is not going nowhere either. When you are selling a product, and my past experience were always in the agency fields, I was actually recruiting for customers. Even when you're talking with customers and when you're selling, it's all about the relationship. You want to be friends with your customer. And in this particular case, your candidates are your customers. So if you don't make friends, if you don't influence people, if people don't like you, if they don't want to establish a connection with you, there's 100 new other companies that they can go. So if your boss does not understand that, this means that you are working in the wrong company. And sooner or later, you need to leave.
It's legit.
That's pretty clear advice there from Anna Tavares. Thank you very much for being so straight with us there.
I'm very straightforward, you know me.
Indeed so. Pedro, you're about to say something.
Yeah, I was actually, I think Mark was commenting here that, you know, platforms like Landing Jobs and Workshape may have to evolve to a more RPO model to have that human component as well. And it might be, you know, like I was saying, maybe it is, you know, because this is very important. I had a question which is, and I know, like I know the answer, but I'm gonna let you answer. Obviously, like you have Pipedrive, we are users of Pipedrive, by the way, and like, do you like take any insights
from Pipedrive usage, from users into your recruitment, because it's also a funnel kind of thing. I know we're going to discuss that, don't we, if it's a funnel or it shouldn't be, but for the time being, I guess it is. So does that give any help you guys, or?
We as a company have a very close connection to our customers in all our departments, being support, being sales, being engineering, being product, whatever it is. We have a lot of companies that are using Pipedrive as almost an ATS. They are using it for recruitment processes. They use the funnel to track what stage the candidate is during the recruitment process. And we have a lot of success cases of using Pipedrive for recruitment. So yes, we have a very, very close relationship to our customers. And we also have a lot of other success cases of customers that use it not only for recruitment but for project management. We also have one case of someone that used it for dating.
What?
Okay. For dating.
what? Jesus Christ.
But they so put their phone book into the Pipedrive.
Yeah. Yeah. They put it all the contacts. They started the funnel with the stage where the dating point were. It was like, yes, we can, Raman. We can integrate with pretty much everything. Probably we would need some workarounds with Tinder. But the truth is, we had a customer asking to integrate with Tinder. We had it already.
You know what? Maybe a systematic approach to dating is the way forward. You know, I mean, I'm currently relying on a lot of serendipity here, you know, going to a bar and hoping for the best. Yeah. You know, put some software to this. Let's put some tooling in there, you know?
Why not?
Okay, Ramandeep, you've just signed up for a trial. There we go.
inbound, huh?
There we go, meet your results. Okay, Anna, listen, I know you're busy because you're there trying to hire people for your team. Very quickly, you're also recruiting for recruiters right now. Is that right? Or what's going on for your team?
Yes. My team is growing, so 2 years ago I started all alone at Pipedrive, starting to build our teams. Now we are a team of four. I am the team lead of the talent acquisition team in Lisbon, and I'm looking for an intern that I want to keep after the internship is over. So if there's someone there willing to join the best recruitment team of the Lisbon tech scene, please contact me on LinkedIn or whatever means you find necessary, we will give you not only experience, best practices, but we will also give you loads of fun.
Right, there we go. A hell of a pitch there by Anna Tavares. Oh, by the way, if you have the link to that job, I'm happy to put it into Recruiting Breakthrough this week.
Okay.
So send it over to me and I'll insert it in there.
Okay, let me find it.
Okay.
One second.
Going live, man.
This is all live.
That's it.
Anna, you know.
Okay.
okay. No worries. Send it to me when you can. But Anna, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, guys.
No worries. I'll see you at the stand a bit later.
See you in a bit.
Great. Take care.
Come and visit us.
All right. See you in a bit.
She's great.
There we go.
There are a lot of great recruiters in this town, man. You have some great talent. I was just thinking. There's a lot of companies, obviously, are very attracted to Lisbon to set up tech teams and so on and so forth. Obviously, with the talent base, the access to the EU marketplace. It's a beautiful city, of course, an attractive place for people to relocate to. We've also seen the response from the recruiter community as well. Some very talented people actually working in TA here, which is fantastic to see. Okay, so where are we with our chat, Pedro? We need to cover a few more points, don't we? Remind me what was on our list, because I totally forgot.
So we have the, I guess we pretty much covered the inbound versus outbound, the anti-recruiter thing. The community. Now, I think we should talk about your presentation, one you did about waterfall versus agile. But I think you should be the one talking about it, not me.
Okay, so I'll very quickly. Pedro has very kindly asked me to do a talk on 2 days ago. And the presentation was all about trying to make the point that there's a big philosophical difference between how recruiters collect and evaluate information compared to how engineers collect and evaluate information. And that is at root, I think, one of the main reasons why we struggle to recruit software engineers. In a very short way of describing it, recruiters still operate in a waterfall method. We collect requirements, we launch a campaign, we pipeline candidates very sequentially, very planned out, all this type of stuff. And we ask developers to enter into a waterfall process. And engineers have long since left that behind. You know, there probably isn't an engineer on the planet, no matter what they might think of Agile currently, but there probably isn't an engineer on the planet that would opt to go back to waterfall. So we probably underestimate what we ask developers to do when we invite them to take an interest in our jobs. And that was basically the thrust of the presentation. I had an email from the only developer in the room. Everyone was a recruiter, right? So
what was the name, by the way? What was the first name?
Gaku Xiao, I think. I forget his second name. But he emailed me and he said, "Hong, I really love the presentation. It was a good description of how mindsets are different between the two populations."
Yeah.
But then he proceeded to correct me also about how developers have moved on to like a post-agile world, and of course he was right also. But yeah, I think that's at root. You know, we apply, if you like, a very waterfall method of thinking about recruitment. Always the candidate pipeline, always the hiring funnel. It's a hydrological metaphor, like the waterfall is a hydrological metaphor. That's important.
Actually, you're talking about hydrological. It reminded me of civil engineering. It's been around for, you know, millenniums, I believe. The Romans did it, the Greeks did it. So, essentially, I mean, you build the bridge, it's the same way, right? More or less the same way. They figured it out for ages. And I think what's happening with software engineering and other types of engineering, new ones, and the recruitment as well, in this new age, is we're figuring out. I think like recruitment in the past, like you were born, I don't know, a baker, your father was in a bakery or whatever, you know, do bread, whatever, bake bread. And that was it. Recruitment was the family, you know. And we've evolved as well. And now we don't know yet how to manage this domain, you know. And that's what I feel with software engineering. That's my background. Like what I felt is like we have no idea, like because we only have like 60 years of operation. That's nothing, you know, if you compare it to civil engineering. And I feel it's the same more or less with recruiting, and we're still figuring out.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, ultimately, what engineers have figured out is that you have to kind of have a position that you don't know what the future looks like. It's unknowable. And the problem you have when you have a waterfall method or a recruiting funnel is that you're sort of saying you do know. This is how you set it up. And you expect this to happen. Very difficult for you to pivot from it. So I guess the thrust of the talk was, look, the developers have been in the agile world for 18 years at least. They're highly resistant to anything that isn't iterative, isn't about maximizing interactions. Whereas recruitment, when they encounter a recruitment situation, they're being asked to go through a non-iterative process and they immediately say no. So what we have to do, I think, is to try and find new ways to interact with people that are based on maximizing interactions. Now, I know we've got a few people. Mark, for instance, has been a pioneer in implementing Agile into ThoughtWorks and other places. And I do think recruitment teams have started to adopt a lot of Agile techniques and methods. But my key point is that Agile stops at the door for recruitment. You know, we are very good at using Agile internally as internal processes. But when we're hiring for external people, we invite them into a waterfall process.
Yeah.
And that's why they resist it.
It's the mindset. You know, we go instantly into a funnel mindset. And to be honest, I have no idea how to change that.
But I think people like the Anna Gaspars and Anna Tavarishes have given us a bit of an idea. It's about, hey,
I think they did.
More community stuff, more long-term interactions, as Lee's mentioned, relationship building. It takes KPIs to change. It takes rewards to change. So business owners have to get there as well. Probably what will happen is that the next generation of business leaders that are a little bit more familiar with agile way of working, and when they start setting up businesses, they probably will more intuitively or not more naturally do this, and we might see that change. Anyway, let's bring on our final guest. I think he should be there. Let me see if I can find him. We had a bit of fun with Alvaro. We had a bit of fun with Alvaro, didn't we? Because there's two Alvaro Rojas's, and I believe we both kind of got a mistake. We invited both of them along without kind of being very confused as to who was who. So I'm still at this point confused as to which Alvaro we're going to get. But I'm very pleased to have Alvaro on. So he's invited, and we'll see if he's able to join us in a sec.
All right.
So
actually, this is a quite good one. It comes after Anna Tavares from Pipedrive, because he's doing a coding bootcamp, and there's like for the past 4 years, there's like more and more coding bootcamps in Lisbon, which is great. Okay, he's asking how he's going to join. So probably he didn't get the invite.
No, he's joining by email. So Alvaro, you're obviously watching this, but check your email, and there should be something that you can accept.
Alvaro Gonzalez. Alvaro Dash Gonzalez. All right. Yeah. This guy's Iron Neck came to Lisbon not that long ago, and they're doing some interesting stuff, which is interesting because Anna was talking about, you know, the more traditional approach to people from universities. And this is an alternative, you know. I can tell you from my, I'm going to keep talking, okay, while we solve the Alvaro inviting thing, okay? My personal story. So my 3 years ago, if you ask me about boot camps, and three years ago, like I was super skeptical about tech boot camps. I have a traditional, I learned in university the computer science course, and these guys, 12 weeks or 9 weeks, and they already know how to code. Who are these people? You know, who do they think they are? You know, this kind of thing. You know, this was my I was super skeptical about it. I actually wrote about it. I'll share it in a bit. And I'm a positive person, and a couple of years ago I decided, okay, it's bias. I'm biased about it. So let's challenge myself. And one of my buddies, he runs another boot camp in Lisbon. And he told me, hey Pedro, there's this guy wrapping up the boot camp. It's really good. Hey, Gonzalo. Hey, Alvaro. Alvaro Gonzalez.
How are you guys?
How are you doing, Alvaro?
Very good. Sorry, I couldn't join. I don't know what happened.
No problem, man. No problem. Great to have you on board. So continue, Pedro. You
talk just to wrap it up. So I had to challenge my own bias, which was stupid, you know, in a way. And we hired a person from bootcamp, and it was great, you know. Like, and he brought that extra. I know we promised not to talk about diversity, but it added a layer of diversity, just not the way I expected.
So let's deal with that one question before we go to Alvaro. So there is a perception, I think, especially among senior tech engineers and tech hiring managers, is that a bootcamp is not the best way to recruit a software engineer, because, hey, how can this guy learn this or this girl learn this in 13 weeks or however long it is? So Alvaro, I'll take it straight to you. Like, how do you handle that conversation? How do you kind of counter that argument?
Very, very simple, I guess. I totally agree that a 5 years education is not a 13 weeks education. So it's a totally different education. We never say that we are educating senior web developers or senior engineers. What we are doing is leveraging in people's career to make them job ready as junior developers. and they have a long way to go to build their seniority as web developers, right? So what we hear from our hiring partners, recently we had a hiring week, and what it's very related to what Pedro was saying. They love the diversity that bootcampers bring to the companies. These people, they have totally different backgrounds, let's say from economics, from finance, civil engineers, psychologists, what else we have here, architects. So the way they think, the way they interact, the social skills, the soft skills they have is super different to the traditional software engineer. And they love having this balance in the teams of bootcampers, 30, 40% of bootcampers, and then, of course, people with more experience, with more software engineering background, right? So it's building...
That's a really...
Great.
No, sorry, Alvaro. I was about to say this is actually a really interesting revelation I didn't think about, because of course a lot of people in boot camps are career changers, so they've actually gone through a different career path. They're not just a comp sci grad out of university constantly just doing engineering. They may have done other stuff which actually might be super useful for a company, but now super. Have technical skills also.
I have hired a lot of people in my working life, and what you can really see is that when you hire someone very, very junior straight from university, there is a long, whatever is your background, very technical or non-technical, learning how to be a professional, there is a learning curve. And these guys, after the bootcamp, average age is 27, 28 years old. They have 5 to 6 years professional experience. They already know how to behave in a company. They already know how to find their way in whatever is the problem. So basically, the learning curve within the company is much faster.
It's the maturity, basically.
Yeah.
And also transferable skills. You know, some, for instance, my wife, she did a boot camp, so she did a career shift essentially. And if she ends up working for a software product in civil engineering, then she has transferable skills from her previous career. Okay, so this is also an add-on as well.
What was she doing before?
Civil engineering.
Civil engineering.
Yeah. So, but she's been at software development for 1 year and a half, I guess. And I had bias. I was skeptical. I tried it. We've hired 3 people from bootcamps.
The latest from Ironhack, I know that.
The latest from Ironhack in Barcelona, a guy from an Italian guy that did the Ironhack bootcamp in Barcelona. And moved to Lisbon.
Yeah.
So okay. He's from Rome, Barcelona, Lisbon.
I've got a question for you, actually, on this, which might help people make that decision, Alvaro. So I'm a hiring manager. I want to hire someone from a bootcamp. But I'm reticent, I'm scared, I'm not sure. So I was like Pedro, let's say, a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What is the way in which should a developer coming from a bootcamp be treated differently compared to a developer that has, let's say, been out of university and come out that way? Is there a way to kind of ensure the success of the developer that's come from, let's say, the Ironhack course?
Okay. First of all, it depends a lot on what you're hiring and what you're looking for. Because at least in Portugal, what we see is that graduates from university, they are learning the traditional frameworks and coding languages. They are perfect in Java, C#. But we are teaching our students React. We are teaching them Angular. Node.js, so more updated technologies. So as a recruiter, you should also think what I need. Do I need someone with more updated skills in the market, or someone with very mathematical overview and that will face more complex challenges, right? So as a junior, if you're hiring juniors, I would say you would need someone that is a fast learner, not someone that is going to lead a team and needs to face more complex challenges. So I would say that the bootcampers, after 10 weeks, they are ready to show you that in 10 weeks what they learned. I come from here, in 10 weeks, I build these 3, 4, 5 projects, and you know how much I can do in 10 weeks. Imagine how much I can do in 1 year. In the opposite, university graduates as a junior, I have my doubts on how they can show you what they are able to grow as a professional once you hire them. Right? So it's I'm not against universities. I don't think a bootcamp is a replacement for universities at this point of history, maybe in a couple of years. But I do believe that our graduates are much more prepared for facing a job than university graduates, that's for sure. I don't know if that answers your question. But.
No, it does. I mean, in the sense that the academic management of learning, if you like, is under challenge, isn't it?
It is.
You know, because they're always going to be teaching stuff that's out of date. We know that. You know, by the time information gets into the university curriculum, it's at 10 years out of date. I knew this at university when I was being taught about just in time and all this type of management techniques, and you know, this at the time of a massive crash in Asia and so on. And it with regards to tech, it's even faster because it's going to change. The best practices and how you build software changes on a weekly basis. So you cannot be teaching here's how you do it at university in a 4-year course and expect that still to be relevant.
If I was a recruiter, which by the way I am not, and I feel a bit of an infiltrate in this community because maybe I'm the only one who is not a recruiter.
We need diversity here also.
We need more people like you.
I wouldn't go to hire a tech team just of bootcampers. Of course not. I think Raman is saying there that university graduates have a better algorithm knowledge, for sure. After 5 years, you have to,
right?
If not, there is a problem. but it's finding the balance between the time you're hiring, right? University graduates.
I'm going to interrupt you rudely here, Gal, because you actually mentioned something as a percentage that was actually an interesting thing. So if I had a team of 100 engineers, like what percentage would you be happy with to see would come from a boot camp, let's say, compared to the traditional routes to entry into that field?
Okay, I am not a recruiter, so I don't have the recruiter view on that side. But what I've seen is that in a team of 100 developers in Spain, I'm thinking of Ironhack Spain, 100 developers in a big company, we have placed 15 people. So there are 15 people at least from Ironhack in a team of 100 developers. So it's a 50% in a company that is a unicorn. So I'm not going to say the name. But.
I would say up to 30%, one third is healthy. You know?
So one third is, I think it's healthy, yeah.
So I guess there probably is a number, isn't there? I mean, when you think about it, there probably is maybe too many, because if there's too many coming from also just bootcamp alone, then maybe they're going to encounter problems that require some stronger algorithmic experience, let's say, or people who've just seen a few more things go on.
And then within the small teams, you also need to find the balance. It's not about the global number, the 15%, 20%, 30% in the global team. But it's in the small teams, in the squads, maybe you have one or two bootcampers, not the full squad working.
I just remembered what was the unblocker for me. I was thinking about this because, I wanted to challenge myself. That's always nice to say. But there was a real unblocker. It was like a lot of people already working in tech, even before bootcamps existed. They were self-taught or dropouts from university. And then I realized, why shouldn't this? It's just another channel, And it's totally fine. And we tried it. It worked. I wouldn't say more than 50%. That could be crazy. But maybe it can work depending on the culture and depending on the challenge itself. Like if you want to build technology for SpaceX, okay, maybe it should be lower, But if you want to, like, if you are hiring for Shopify, Facebook, for that matter, maybe it can be a lot higher, you know?
Yeah.
So it depends on the challenge itself. Like, for instance, I was saying, as an example, cybersecurity. And that's super complicated, you know? And not saying that bootcampers won't get there, but straight out of a bootcamp, for sure, no. And there's other disciplines within the tech world like this. Mm-hmm. And I would say, like, in terms of, we were talking about inbound before, Hung, and essentially, like, I think this is a long run challenge, you know, to change the mindset of the hiring managers and the recruiters as well. I would say it's easier to change the mindset of the recruiters because it's a new challenge. So I would say the real challenge is in the hiring managers. And changing their mindset, because even if a recruiter says, "Oh, there's these guys I met from Ironhack Lisbon, let's go there," blah blah, and then the Ironman cancels them out, then what's the point, right?
Mm-hmm. And there is another second bounce of the bootcamps, which is people coming to learn coding, not necessarily to work as a developer. I imagine you hire a UX designer that knows how to code, or a marketeer that knows how to code. So the having coding as a superpower on any role is amazing.
It's kind of upskilling in a way. Sort
you
of.
Know what? That's actually a really good point. I mean, I wonder whether you could maybe do a custom course for this, Alvaro, because even in recruiting, this is a very common topic, because there's a bunch of recruiters I know that, you know, call themselves recruiters who code. Because these are recruiters that have self-directed themselves to learn some basic coding, because it's actually very useful to do. You know, if you're able to automate a lot of your processes, for instance, with a script, actually you might be super efficient. Or if you're able to have a deeper understanding as to how technology can be optimized, you'll actually, you know, the tools that you're spending money on, you're actually going to get much greater value from it. Yeah. So. I just wonder whether in the strategy of bootcamps like Ironhack, is there something in there where you can say, right, the end state is not to produce developers, but actually to increase the technical literacy of non-developers. And then there's a different course for that, because maybe I don't need 10 weeks in a bootcamp to do that.
It's for sure 100% in part of our strategy. We are in early stage of releasing bootcamps for companies. So companies coming to us, we did a couple of samples and pilots, one in Germany and another in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
The Mexico one was with Google, for example. So it was 10 marketeers of Google learning front-end coding. That's it. And they are going, and it was in a part-time format during 2 months. So they are learning front-end for their role at Google. And I think it's where we are going to grow a lot in the coming years. So being part of the training, reskilling that companies are investing in their employees.
Yeah, that's so, called upskilling. And upskilling. You also had the Germany one, which was the reskilling part, right?
Yeah, the Germany one. It was an electronic European retailer, a big one. That was totally different approach. They were in a situation where, do we fire 100 people or we reskill 100 people? What is better? And you know, they decided to reskill them as a junior.
I was about to say exactly this, because, you know, especially with if you like more tenured employees that maybe are getting older in their experience, but they've kind of kept their skills at a dated level now, the options of just getting rid of them are socially unacceptable. We need to upskill these people so that they can continue to be productive members of the business. It'll be cheaper and better for the company.
And there is good research that shows that the economics are better reskilling than firing.
Yeah. If you have that research, Alvaro,
I'd love to send it to you.
I'd love to see it. That'll be fantastic. Okay. Okay, listen, guys, we're coming to the end of the show. We're kind of running way over time. And I know that Alvaro's got more important things to do than to speak to us. And in fact, I'm also running out of energy on my laptop also. So this might just dramatically cut. So I'll see you later at your stand. So I'll catch you later. Thank you very much for your contribution, man.
Thank you, guys. See you later on tomorrow.
Cheers.
And Pedro, I'll just end with this. I mean, it's been a great show. Thank you for spending time with me, man. It's been great to step out of the hubbub of the scene. I mean, you can see what's going on here, you know? Very active. People are probably booze now, which is another reason why I'm
wanting to get ours, man.
Yeah, we need to get out.
I'll meet you in a sec.
So listen, thank you so much for your time, Pedro. It's been fantastic to put you on here. We'll definitely get you back. This is me signing off. This is Brain Food Live on air. If you enjoyed the show, please follow the channel. We try and do this every week. This will also be a podcast, so if you're audio only, you can follow the podcast as well. Next week, we've got a super exciting show for you because we're talking about early career talent. How do we deal with making your business competitive to the next generation of people entering the workforce? We've got some amazing guests to join us for that, including the founders of White Hat, Ewan Blair, and Sophie Edelman. So log in for that and sign up for it. And we will see you next week.
Thanks. Bye.